This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin, joined by Health and Living producer Tina Camellia. We're taking a hand-picked approach to some of the best shows or some of the most weighty shows that we did throughout the year that covered some major issues. We've kind of segmented it. We've had pediatrics, orthopedics, that was last week, and you can check out those podcasts. But today we're talking about something very important that just doesn't get talked about enough for some reason, mental health.
So mental health is finally getting the attention it needs. By 2020, 1 in 10 Malaysians will be affected by mental problems based on the Health Ministry's 2013 findings. We've had a couple of psychiatrists on a monthly basis, Dr. Philip George and Dr. Stephen Jambudanan. But first, we take a look at the dark side of mental health institutions.
If you mention Hospital Bahagia or Tanjung Rambutan, everyone knows what you're referring to. And I don't think people tend to think of it in any other way except derogatory, sadly. But what really happens behind its doors and who gets sent there? Consultant forensic psychiatrist Dr. Hajar Rabaya Mohamed Saleh from Hospital Bahagia Ulu Kinta shares.
Frankly, we do not encourage people to come to Hospital Bahagia or Hospital Permai. Not all psychiatric patients or those with mental illness need to be admitted. You must understand, like mental illness is like any other illnesses. We all go through the processes. You have some of the symptoms, you go and see the doctor, and they give you medication, and you go back. So the same thing applies to those with mental illness. Those who think that they have mental illness, they can go and see a doctor in any general hospital. You get your treatment, you go as outpatient. So therefore, the only people who need to come to be admitted anywhere, whether it's a general hospital or psychiatric institution, will be those who are suicidal or those who are homicidal. Homicidal means they're very, very dangerous. This Hospital Bahagia, we have acute admissions, short-term admissions, and long-stay patients, and the cases sent in by the courts or forensic patients. An example of referrals that we usually get is from Hospital Kuala Lumpur. And Hospital Kuala Lumpur also receives patients from elsewhere, from around Selangor and Wilayah. Some of the patients are vagabonds. Vagabonds when they don't have places to go to. Or some of the patients, they have family, but family says, I think they need a long stay or whatever. So for whatever reasons, the psychiatrists think that they will benefit, the patients will benefit from a longer rehab program, they will send to Bahagia. Psychiatric institution should only be for forensic patients. Psychiatric institution shouldn't be meant for any acute cases. And talking about institutions, yeah? Mm-hmm. It's just only meant for people with forensic background, people who may not be charged in court but have antisocial personality, who have been destructive, I mean with illnesses, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. They can be here for longer term treatment. No more revolving door. You're admitted for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, we send you home and then you come back after 6 months. We don't want that. That one should go to the general hospitals. Right. Only if you're a threat to society in a big way. Yeah.
Consultant psychiatrist Dr. Philip George described the importance of deinstitutionalization of mental health patients.
Well, the concept really came about sometime in the late 60s when they noticed that patients who were in hospital sort of settings for long periods of time were actually getting into a syndrome that was actually even more damaging to them than being out in the public. They were in environments that were non-stimulating, mm-hmm. and so they would be very isolated. They'd lose contact with people, lose social skills, lose ability to do things, and even cognitively be affected. And so they won't be able to make decisions or judgments or even know the day or time or place. And so there was controversy about whether this was because of the illness, because a lot of the people in this long stay admission facilities were suffering from schizophrenia, which is also known to cause this sort of condition. Or was it the environment? And later on, it was identified that the environment did play a huge role, that institutions could then create institutionalization in people, and that would then disable them further, making them dependent and unable to get out into the community again. So it largely became a human right issue. Do we condemn people to an institution which is going to make them worse and then effectively take them away from the whole opportunity of being reintegrated into society?
This idea of deinstitutionalization, do you think we've gone too far with it?
Well, it hasn't happened here locally in Malaysia as much as we would have hoped. I know some of the institutions have actually downsized the numbers in their submissions. But we haven't gotten to a level where we can say we're really deinstitutionalized mentally ill people. In other countries, yes, it may have actually gone a little bit extreme. And that's led to larger numbers of people who are homeless, larger number of people who are, in and out of prisons, and having other issues as well.
How, in other ways, can we create safe places for people who need support?
Yeah, so generally, if we're intending to actually reduce numbers in the institutions, which would be of benefit to the patient, and, of course, a big cost-cutting measure, is if we have proper community service support systems. Sheltered homes, sheltered workshops for those who can actually be functional a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Community mental health teams, assertive teams that go out and see the patient daily, give them their medication, assess and see that they're doing well, that they're, got all the skills to be able to manage on their own. So we need to have the community support and systems in place. What we have noticed with trying to deinstitutionalize people is that there are a certain segment of people with serious mental illness that do need, full-time, regular, continuous support. But we need to provide the right environment. It has to be, something that's going to be therapeutic for them. Not just throw them away and lock the keys in a prison-like area and, wait for them to die. And we need to strengthen the community mental health services so that people don't end up in that sort of situation and people come in for therapy and treatment early.
And families also have an important role to play in reintroducing the patients to the community.
The immediate family, you must not break this bond. That is why we do not like to keep them too long. Okay, you must be returned back to sender. It is unfortunate that there are some families, we have so many sad stories. We have what we call a unit discharge, a home discharge unit here.
Yes.
Because otherwise, families do not want to take them. I won't say all families, but I would say some of the families are not ready to take their patients home, their family home. So we have a unit to send them back to the door. If you come from somewhere in Kanga, for example, or Pulau Pinang, we send them back to the doorstep.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, some of the families, they change addresses.
Right.
Easily, I can tell you that I have about 700 patients who are here for long stay. 700.
Who ideally can go back to the community?
Maybe it's a bit too late for them to go back now because they don't have immediate families. And we talk about immediate families, we're talking about father, mother, brothers, sisters. When you have cousins, they have been here for about 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. Parents have died off. My patients are already in that 50s, 60s age, so that's a sad part.
So what is the future of mental health institutions? Dr. Hajar Rabaya had the following message.
I'm ashamed to tell any outside visitors, any foreigners who come to visit to say that we are a 2,000-bedded hospital. So for the next 10 years, what I'm saying is now, Hostel Bahagia should be, I don't think we can achieve that, but should be going downwards. We must be 500. And even that 500 is very big. But for forensic, that's what you have. 200 is forensic. So you should be only for forensic patients and for behavior modification programs. Yeah? That's it. Not for the nursing care, not for the acute care. For the acute care, should be taken by the general psychiatrist in the general hospitals and the community psychiatrist. For the geriatric care, but the elderly who needs only tender nursing care, it can be elsewhere, but not psychiatric institution.
Mm-hmm.
Ms. Mira.
And ideally, patients should be there for the shorter term rather than the longer term?
Ideally, it should be that way, shorter term.
But in some cases, they don't have a choice?
Some cases, they don't have a choice. We'll keep them. That's our duty. That's our duty to the patients. That's our duty to the public, to keep the patients safe from the public and the public safe from the patients. But what I want to impress on the listeners is when you get them treated early, they will get well and they are just like you and I. They can be holding a job, they can be fathers, they can be mothers, they can be you know, useful citizens, but get help early, then institutions like us will not be so big. More big institutions like this. 500, which 10 years I think is a bit difficult, but, well, maybe the next generation we should be. Lower than that.
You are listening today to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, and we're talking about mental health in our Best of 2016 series. Up next, we examine the relationship between violence and mental illness, which I think, well, just to give you a snapshot of what we're going to cover, really doesn't quite exist, even though it does in the popular imagination. It doesn't in terms of numbers and science, but we'll get to that. You are listening to Health and Living. This is BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Health and Living. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Health and Living producer Tina Camellia is here also. We are taking a look at our Best of series in 2016 for Health and Living particularly, and today it's all about mental health.
So every now and then we hear about mass murder, killers, and the killer is often said to be mentally ill. So for example, Omar Mateen, the murderer behind the Orlando nightclub attack, Mohamed Lawesh Boulel behind the Bastille Day attack, pilot Andreas Lubitz, German Wings Flight 9525 that crashed in the French Alps. So we explore the links between mental health and violence with Dr. Philip George.
There's two things. There's mental health and there's mental illness. And we go through good and bad mental health throughout our lives. I mean, every day can be, you know, a fluctuation of mental health where, you know, you start off the morning feeling positive and then later on you get some bad news and you feel down, and then later somebody says something, you feel angry, and, you know, so that's mental health issues. Mental illness is specific. You know, it has to have certain sort of criteria met for a certain period. It has to interfere with their day-to-day functioning. So if a person has schizophrenia, that's a mental illness. But people with mental health problems can commit crime because at that stage, you know, mentally they were a little disturbed but didn't have a mental illness. So I think everyone has got a mental health issue that provokes violence or provokes aggression. But what's behind that mental health issue is the important thing. You know, if you can't manage your stress and you don't have maybe a balanced lifestyle or, you know, friends that you can lean on, then, yeah, maybe perhaps your mental health problems become more. But people with mental illness can actually have a balanced lifestyle and learn how to deal with their stress and issues, you know, with interventions and treatment.
Here's the thing, though. Is there actually a link between mental health and violence? Mental health, is it synonymous with being dangerous? Could you elaborate on that? Is that just a myth?
Yeah. No, I think it is really a myth. And I think that's my take-home message from this show. A lot of studies have been done, and overall, it shows that the mentally ill are no more violent than people, the normal people. I mean, again, who's normal to start with? But yeah, so they're no more violent. And sometimes, in some conditions, they may be perhaps just as violent. There is no difference between those with mental illness and the normal general population. Self-harm is actually more common than violence towards others in people with mental illness. In fact, 90% of suicides around the world are reported related to mental health issues, and the most common cause is major depression. Even in our own experience in psychiatry, patients who are admitted to a psychiatric ward are usually because of risk of violence to themselves or to others. And we have more male admissions than female admissions. We have more male beds than female beds in all psychiatric hospitals and units throughout the country. So, yes, it is more gendered in terms of males more than females. But again, some of the risk factors, when they occur together, then it may also increase the risk in females as well to be aggressive and violent.
And why does the gender line exist?
Yeah, well, basically with symptoms in mental illness itself, they vary from male to female. And so in males, it may be more behavioral. And so that's where aggression and violence may occur. In females, it may be more related to thought and processes. And so, you know, there may be less in terms of behavioral symptoms. Very often we see women with mental illnesses being protected by communities for years on end. They may be locked away in a room. They don't come out. They just stay away. And there's, you know, they're easily hidden because they don't act out on it. But men would act out, and so they sometimes actually come in for treatment at an earlier stage than women do. And that's a little sad because, you know, the earlier they do come in for treatment, the higher the chance of recovery. And so we need to maybe take away from our mindset the fact that, you know, when a person has an unusual behavior or an altered sort of, you know, psyche, that it doesn't matter whether they're male or female, they can seek treatment and get better. There's two things. There's mental health and there's mental illness. And we go through good and bad mental health throughout our lives. I mean, every day can be, you know, a fluctuation of mental health where, you know, you start off the morning feeling positive and then later on you get some bad news and you feel down. And then later somebody says something, you feel angry. And, you know, so that's mental health issues. Mental illness is specific. You know, it has to have certain sort of criteria met for a certain period. It has to interfere with their day-to-day functioning. So if a person has schizophrenia, that's a mental illness. But people with mental health problems can commit crime because at that stage, you know, mentally they were a little disturbed but didn't have a mental illness. So I think everyone has got a mental health issue that provokes violence or provokes aggression. But what's behind that mental health issue is the important thing. You know, if you can't manage your stress and you don't have maybe a balanced lifestyle or, you know, friends that you can lean on, then, yeah, maybe perhaps your mental health problems become more. But people with mental illness can actually have a balanced lifestyle and learn how to deal with their stress and issues, you know, with interventions and treatment.
It's hard enough, however, to get anyone to seek professional help with their mental health. So how do you go about it, especially when it's someone who has a violent tendency?
So the first thing is use the right language. And I think it would be not using the you word and accusing and criticizing, but more of the I word of, you know, I feel concerned, I feel worried, and looking at a medical model rather than the mental health model, especially in Malaysia, because a lot of people have different connotations when it comes to mental health. So looking at, you know, there are medical reasons why people lose control of their anger and temper and, you know, get more violent or frustrated easily. And so it'd be good to see perhaps a general practitioner or, you know, your family doctor to get an assessment. People with high thyroid levels can also have, you know, increase irritability, anger, and lack control over their aggression as well. So first medicalizing it, getting them to think about seeing someone, and then, of course, the general practitioners, some of them who are trained, would be able to assess for mental health problems as well.
So the US presidential campaign got everyone talking. We wondered if Donald Trump is delusional, but how does it really develop, and how can delusions be prevented?
With each of these themes, you know, persecution, jealousy, infidelity, you can see how they all start with very small triggers. I mean, persecution could just start with, well, feeling like a victim one day, and then the next day is still a bad day, and then perhaps it grows and grows, and you start to believe that, why is the world against me? How do you stop a sense of victimhood, for example, from growing into a delusion of persecution?
Well, firstly, early detection and the proper intervention. It's very difficult if you are alone, but if you are with somebody with that kind of beliefs, the best thing to do would be to seek advice or get this person to see somebody, see a doctor. A feeling, if not causing dysfunction, is fine, but when it causes dysfunction or upsets others, then I think it's delusional.
And could there also be underlying traumatic experiences that might make you more likely to delusions? For example, if you've experienced infidelity in a way that was very, very, very harmful to you, might that make you more prone to delusions of infidelity in the future?
Yes, surely. Again, using the good old biopsychosocial model, you might have a genetic predisposition to overdeveloped dopamine in your brain that would lead to delusions. Psychology being the way you think, and social being your environment. So all these three components will contribute in different ways to one developing a delusion. So if you have experienced a very traumatic infidelity experience, yes, it would and will contribute towards one forming a delusion if you have that biological component and that psychological way of thinking.
And do we see a linear progression of delusions? I mean, can you track it? You know, is there a point in time where you can say, well, this has crossed over into...
Yes. Most of the time it's very obvious, but sometimes it's a bit difficult, especially when people around this deluded person supports the delusion. And the delusion just gets stronger and stronger, and you wonder sometimes, is it true or not? Whether this person is what they say they are. When a person has a delusion, they normally don't have insight. So they're not aware that it's not true. They may present to the hospital themselves because they may be unhappy about what they can't achieve, or they may be unhappy about their safety, depending on the delusion. But normally they are brought in by family members and friends.
Is it an easy disorder to diagnose?
Delusional disorder, schizophrenia, and other conditions which have delusions normally also have hallucinations, except for delusional disorder. So it is quite easily diagnosed, yes.
We were talking about delusions for the whole episode, but the most memorable part about that interview wasn't necessarily about delusions, but actually this last caller that came in that I will remember for a very long time.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, doctor. I'm kind of a stuck, so I just need your opinion to tell me that I'm not insane or I'm not going insane.
Okay.
Okay. I'm married. I have a son from my previous marriage. And my wife has SLE, autoimmune acute arthritis, and thyroid. So, and my wife and my mom don't get along. And all three of them are staying separate. For me to divide time among all these three is absolutely making me insane. And whenever my wife is very active, she's still working, but whenever she calls me or anything, I get so worried that I have to rush back to her. This is, I just cannot spend time with my son. I don't get to see my son. I don't get to see my mother so much. And I just do not know how to put it in words, but this is driving me nuts. I mean, at times that I thought that I'm working as a safety officer and I'm always on the high-rise buildings and so on. Sometimes you're at the high-rise at the level, at the edge of the building, and the thought that runs through your head, I believe I can fly. You understand what I'm trying to say?
Yes, yes, I do.
Yeah.
Please go on.
I don't know whether I'm going insane or it's just too much for me to bear.
Well, I really empathize with you because you seem to be spread really, really thin. I suggest you go and see a doctor, get some time off, and get some rest. You may be depressed, not insane.
I cannot afford to take time off because my son is still in school, so mm-hmm. I need to provide for him. My mom is old, mm-hmm. and I need to provide for her medical and her house rent and her daily expenditures and everything. So does with my wife. My wife does not know that I am taking out extra income to support these two. She's unaware of it.
Well,
and if I take break, mm-hmm. I have to cut these two off, and which is impossible for me to do.
Sometimes when we run on overdrive for too long, our body gets depleted of something called serotonin, something we all have. And when that happens, we become weaker and we get really, we become sad, sad and anxious. If you go to the nearest hospital from where you live or where you work, you could see a psychiatrist. There are lots of doctors around. You could see a psychiatrist, or for that matter, even a GP who could start you on something to help you gain back that energy and that motivation and that drive. It would take about a week or two to start working, but you must go and see a doctor soon.
I am currently on Covercel.
On what, sorry?
Covercel, because I had a near-miss stroke twice.
That doesn't help in your serotonin. You would need something, what we call an antidepressant, and that would boost up everything.
Okay.
And the stress is going to, you don't want another stroke. So please go as soon as you can. It's a very simple procedure. And it's just one tablet a day and you will feel better. And then you'll be able to tackle your problems better too.
I'm not insane, right?
No. Please, just go to the nearest doctor and get some help for your serotonin. You're not insane.
I'm not a doctor, but you're not insane. Anybody would find that very difficult to cope with, Shama, I think.
Thank you so much. I just needed to hear that. Thank you so much.
Thank you for calling.
It's a bit sad, but I think we live in a deluded world, and we should all try and do something about it and to make things more real.
Moving on, there's been numerous creepy clown sightings, particularly in the US and the UK a couple of months ago. The creepy clown craze got us thinking about phobias.
In this episode, Tina also tried to address her phobia of of going live on air. And anyway, you know, nobody dies, Tina. Anyway, but what is the difference between a phobia and a fear?
Phobias, it's irrational, meaning that you'd even fear them by looking them, you know, seeing them on TV. And it might freak you out and cause a panic attack, which is very different from just normal fears.
So phobia then, again, It has to be irrational in order to be classified as a phobia?
Well, it has to be excessive, intense, and yes, often irrational as well. So it is an anxiety disorder. It's one of the 5 different types of anxiety disorders. And so with all the anxiety disorders, the common thing or the common theme is that they have anxiety symptoms, which are physical and psychological. And these symptoms then, you know, become quite disabling. The person then is unable to do anything. They're trapped with this anxiety. And so in phobias, there is a stimuli. Whereas, for example, in panic disorder, there's no stimuli. It just happens out of the blue for no reason. And then in generalized anxiety disorder, it's constant. It's always there. In post-traumatic stress disorder, it comes on when you think about the event that happened in the past that was life-threatening. So it varies from condition to condition. The other anxiety disorder is obsessive-compulsive disorder, where the anxiety comes about when you try and resist the obsessions or the compulsions that you have. So if you try and resist washing your hands like 250 times, you get into this anxiety symptoms with the physical and the psychological symptoms. So fear is a normal emotional reaction. But fear is not often disabling. It doesn't affect your work. It doesn't affect relationships. It doesn't, you know, stay in your mind continuously. And, you know, so it's something that you can live with. So like people have fear of, you know, mice and cockroaches and, you know, maybe even spiders. But when it gets to a level where, let's say, you've been to a friend's house or you're sitting in your office and you see a spider and you say, I'm not coming to work ever again, that's an irrational fear. So you can classify phobias into simple phobias. So these are the ones that we've been talking about so far, the ones that are related to animals and objects and situations and even blood and injury and injections. And then others. So there are 5 types of specific phobias. And then there are 2 other phobias, one called agoraphobia. Agro means marketplace. So it means, you know, crowded areas. People are fearful of crowded areas or even the opposite, vast open spaces. So you put someone, for example, in the middle of a football field and they get into this phobia. They get into the anxiety. The real problem here is that they are fearful about not being able to escape, not being able to get out and go back to where they're more comfortable at. And the third is social phobia. We're seeing an increase in social phobia and agoraphobia. Those are the 2 more common ones. Of course, specific phobias, you know, they vary from individual to individual. But in social phobias, specifically, people feel fearful about being embarrassed in public. So it's not like, you know, you are going up to do a public speech or, you know, that's normal fear. If you're going to be on radio for the first time, yeah, that's normal fear. But if you feel that it's actually going to embarrass you, you're going to be ridiculed and your face is going to change and everyone's going to laugh at you and you never want to do this, then that's social phobia. And so a lot of people with social phobia avoid encounters with people. They don't go to parties, they don't go to dinners. Even eating in front of others makes them very uncomfortable. They're worried that people are observing what they're doing and how they're eating and, you know, that it's all unusual. And so it really puts a dent on, you know, what they can do in life as well.
And what can we do to overcome our fear?
First step is actually self-help. And a lot of phobias at the early stages can actually be helped on their own. There's a lot of stuff online that actually help with phobias. There's eCouch, which is an online therapy portal, and Mood Gym, which is also another online therapy portal, which provides therapy for free. You need to register and you need to provide some information, but all that is confidential. And they can then take you through steps in trying to overcome phobias and fears as well. But they usually work in the early stages. So once it's enshrined and it's starting to, you know, cause a disability, it's often best to think about seeing a professional then. But usually, typically, with the early stages, you can actually then expose yourself through things online, through what do you call images and even, what do you call that, sort of 3D sort of activities. And therapy has evolved into those things as well. So people can actually put themselves into a situation where they're actually experiencing it online.
Virtual reality.
Virtual reality, right. That's the word for it. Yeah, virtual reality. And so that's come into therapy as well. So that's available online. And so people can actually try and use that first as self-help before they actually, you know, see a professional. Generally, to come to a diagnosis of phobia, you need to have a duration of 6 months. Once it's already hit the 6 month mark, it's already fit. I mean, there are neurochemical changes, there are psychological changes. You've made changes in your whole lifestyle as well. So therapy takes time to actually find some, you know, resolve. Usually, if medications are used, they take about 4 to 6 weeks to start to have an effect. So that's the area where we find a challenge. Because a lot of patients want a quick fix. You know, they've come with this fear. It's affecting their life. They may be on a flight next week and they're hoping to, you know, overcome everything within a jiffy. But that typically doesn't happen. It is a process. Most often, it's about a month to 2 months before people can actually start to see some response. And again, it's often best as a combination. So, you know, a psychiatrist and a psychologist together trying to help a person with a biopsychosocial illness.
If you have any worries about your mental health or anything that's weighing you down, speak up. We're listening and we will have our mental health shows. We'll continue to go on and that is an area for you to talk about it. You can also talk to us, biggerpicture@bfm.my. And if you'd like to listen to those shows in full, you can find the podcasts on bfm.my as well as on our app. Tomorrow, we take a look at our inaugural health event in which a number of really interesting topics were brought up. This is Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.